This is the first of six sermons before I leave St. Matthew's. In these sermons, I want to revisit some of the central ideas that underpin how I understand God, Jesus, the Church, and our common baptismal vocation. In Anthony de Mello's Song of the Bird, the reading we've just heard, he asks, how can we know God? And answers, we can't. Why then, he goes on, do we try to speak about God at all? He replies, why does the bird sing? Knowing God is a big question, for God is the biggest matrix imaginable, or rather unimaginable. This vastness called God is bigger than our perceptions, ideas and projections. God is beyond us. God is bigger too than our language. Indeed, words, as many of us who try to engage with God through prayer discover, are often inadequate, and silence is our primary tongue. In Reformed theology, this vastness is often referred to as the sovereignty of God. In the Anglican contemplative tradition, this vastness is referred to as the mystery of God. The sovereignty tradition suffers from the hierarchical notions of power that have long dominated the political and religious landscape. It posits that God has unlimited power and control. This, of course, makes God into a monster when innocents suffer or an earthquake happens. If God has the power to prevent tragedy and doesn't, then God is immoral. However, the life and teachings of Jesus point to quite a different type of power, that of costly love. Such love, I would posit, is the defining essence or sovereignty of God, not power and control. There are incidences in the Gospel, particularly the fourth Gospel, where Jesus is portrayed as in control of everything, including his own death. I would suggest, however, that these are the result of writers and editors reflecting back on Jesus' life and adding their own gloss on the events that happened. I think it's a more accurate portrait of Jesus that he loved compassionately and courageously beyond the accepted boundaries and laws and then suffered the consequences. He was faithful to his vocation to love and to his God. He was not a powerful king who could snap his fingers and have an army of angels descend and beat up the bad guys like Herod and Pilate and their sycophants. That's a fantasy. The reading from Mark 9 of Jesus presenting a child as the greatest is an example, I think, of not only how we should view and treat the least powerful, not only a critique of political structures, including the church, but a pericope and insight on the very nature of God. In our culture, we generally attribute value to those who have power, physical, financial, or political. And we typically attribute greatness to such people. Throughout history and still today, there's a correlation of power and greatness and gender. It is the powerful and authoritative males, fathers, lords, and kings, who are seen to be the greatest. Jesus challenges this notion of greatness. Children occupied a lowly place in the first century household, for Jews and Romans alike. Although they represented the future, they were at present a liability, may be due to the high incidence of infant mortality. Many historians compare their status to that of a servant or slave. By calling a child the greatest, Jesus is once again turning his world topsy-turvy, reversing expectations, promoting a radical egalitarianism and solidarity with those of lowly status and vulnerability. However, I would also suggest that Jesus is making a theological comment. For great or greatness is a name for God in the Hebrew Scriptures. Jesus is saying that the greatness of God is not the power of all-knowing and all-controlling lords and kings, but the greatness of God is revealed in the way a child is treated with dignity, respect, nurture, protection, and love. God is a way of compassion, not a being overlooking and determining the state of the world. God is revealed in the way Jesus treated children, marginalized, and those excluded. God is, to use Carter Hayward's definition, the power of mutual relationships, or St. John's, God is love. God is not a being who loves. God is the very essence of transformative, mutual, self-giving love. The notion of the sovereignty or vastness of God is also about freedom. Initially in the 16th century, this might have been expressed in terms of God not being bound by our needs and our expectations. But it goes further than that. God is usually shaped by cultures and the elites of those cultures. We project onto God personality, authority, likes and dislikes. And hence Christianity has inherited this male king God who's going to barbecue the bad guys and reward the good guys, and who bears very little resemblance to the words and actions of Jesus. However, there's a problem when we think about God and projection. For haven't we all, as Lloyd Gehring might say, made God? Isn't my notion of God being a power of transforming love a projection? Sure, I can argue that the way of Jesus revealed such a God. But one can also argue, probably more convincingly, that Jesus, following his first century heritage, understood God very anthropomorphically, as a fatherly being, albeit with a kind heart. Our projections onto God, of course, are shaped by our experiences of sacredness and our experiences of life in general. We experience God in various ways, through the scriptures, through prayer, through trauma, through beauty, through being loved. Some believe that such experiences of the sacred are just formations of our own mind. Others, like me, hold to a mystery of sacredness that is beyond me, beyond my mind, and beyond our minds. The notion of God's freedom suggests that we need to be both humble and self-critical in our language about the divine. Ultimately, we don't know what God is. God is a mystery. We hope certain things, we trust certain things, we've experienced certain things, but ultimately we don't know. This doesn't mean we shouldn't call an idol for what it is. And the male God is an idol. Every notion of God becomes so dominant, so set in concrete, like Father has, that locks God in, is idolatrous. God is not fixed. God is fluid. God is not personal. God is transpersonal. God is not big. God is bigger than big and way bigger than us. Reformed theology of the Barthian variety, that's Karl Barth, not Bart Simpson, might, Bart Simpson's very theological actually, might agree with my ideas about the vastness of God, but would say that God in God's freedom chose to self-disclose through the scriptures, creation, and in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. God chose to self-disclose in being incarnated. But I don't think Bart solves the problem of knowing God. Creation is a nice metaphor, but actually the world evolved. The scriptures weren't written by God or even dictated by God, and they reflect the prejudices, ignorance, and of course the wisdom of their time. Jesus, no matter how exemplary his life, was a human being, time-bound and culture-bound. Some of what he said was not forever true. He got some things wrong, and some of those things weren't edited out by the gospel writers. I can, though, like most Christians, say that in Jesus we see God. Not all of God, of course, but a glimpse of the essence, a way of being, a way of loving, a way that we believe as a church was vindicated by the resurrection of that community of his first followers. Jesus offers us a way to live and a grace in which to live it. The scriptures at their best point to this way of love and mutuality. So this bird, Glyn, has sung. I've tried to talk about that which is beyond language, something of an oxymoron. And I'll keep singing. I think God is a way, an experience, a smile and a song, not a fixed entity, a being, a demand, or a father king. God is known in the way that a child is respected and honored. God is known when the little and the least are prioritized before the powerful and the pious. This is the way in which I try to walk and which shapes my prayer.